What we find really moves the needle on your health is to adjust your lifestyle and live the way the body is programmed to live before we look outward.
Hi, welcome to Resonate, conversations and life lessons from Rancho La Puerta. I'm your host, Barry. As someone whose mom was a bit of a health nut early on, I got interested in wellness and nutrition at an early age. I was the kid who was not allowed to buy school lunches because they weren't healthy, and my mom would pack our lunch every day. Usually consisted of a sandwich with peanut butter and sprouts made on this whole grain bread that my mom made herself that was as heavy as a brick. Chips, no way. We would have a bag of celery and carrot sticks, maybe an apple. Soda pop, no. We would have a canning jar with some kind of juice concoction that she made. Needless to say, I could never trade my lunch with anyone else. But it got me interested really early on, and I studied wellness, health, and nutrition in school, and I've been working in this industry for many years. Ever since the internet has exploded, it doesn't matter what I'm on, whether I'm on YouTube, Instagram, even Facebook, I'm bombarded with all this information about nutrition and hacks and things you should and things you shouldn't do. I get really confused, especially when it comes to supplements. So I'm excited today because my guest is Linda Illingsworth, and she's a registered dietitian. She's an expert in this field. She does some contract work for Rancho La Puerta, and she also works at a wellness institute. So I have been keeping a track of all these questions I have for her, and I'm excited to hear what the expert has to say. Hi, Linda. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Barry. Thanks for having me.
You're coming all the way from an hour up the road in beautiful San Diego, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Which I always like to find out.
Very exotic, yes.
So let's tell them a little bit. You're a registered dietitian, correct?
Yes.
And you work at a really cool place now, because I know I belong, the Life Wellness Institute, but it's kind of looking at the whole body. So there's an exercise physiologist, there's doctors, and you're the nutritionist there.
Yes.
But you've also worked in the spa world.
Yes, I have. I've worked at several destination health spas, one of them being Rancho La Puerta, which is amazing. Can't say enough wonderful things about the ranch and their approach to health and wellness and nutrition. So I have a good background in destination health and health spas, and also in working in medical clinics and doing corporate wellness, things like that.
One of the things that you do for the ranch, you currently work for us and you're doing this podcast with me, but you also, guests that are coming in with dietary needs, you reach out to them in advance, you help analyze diets and all those kind of things, which is great. And we appreciate that.
Yeah,
and,
that's great.
So what got you interested in nutrition?
In nutrition? Well, when I was in college, I really wanted to be a veterinarian. And so I was on that track. I had registered to be pre-veterinarian and was going through all the science and that. And my father was diagnosed with heart disease, and he actually needed a quadruple bypass surgery and went in for that. And back then, we didn't have statins. We didn't have a lot of things. They were just pioneering bypass surgery. So he was one of the first people kind of to go through that. And it didn't go well the first round, and he ended up with a second quadruple bypass surgery and ultimately passed away from it. But in that process, nutrition was what we used really to help with cardiovascular disease, because there weren't so many medicines available. And I became very interested in nutrition and helping my father with it and his understanding of it. And so then I just kind of got hooked and became a nutrition major instead, and the rest is history.
The rest is history. That's great. Yeah. Well, I'm excited today because I get to talk to you, and I love to talk to you, and I have so much I want to talk to you about. But one of the things that I think is big now is that there's so much on social media. Like, I'm on YouTube all the time, or, you know, even on Facebook, Instagram. There's so much information out there about diets and nutrition and what you should do, what you shouldn't do. What advice do you have for people? Because I know I've found some of this stuff is completely not true.
It's so hard to tell. And it's very difficult to tell who's simply parroting what they've heard from another podcast, or if they've actually read the research, or if they actually work in clinical practice, which is very different than research, which is what a lot of people don't understand. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult to sift through it. And I would say if you're really into it, I would find a trusted medical professional. And it might be a doctor who has a lot of good nutrition information or knowledge, but often doctors are not well-trained in nutrition. They're well-trained in a million other things medical, but nutrition isn't one of them. So finding a registered dietitian, and I usually recommend people look for dietitians with integrative practice, integrative nutrition, or functional nutrition kind of in their title or their approach, because then they're looking at that whole body approach, and they tend to have wider views and maybe have seen a little more of the research, of that, if you will, not always. Mm-hmm. That may not be the fairest description. But if you're somebody who listens to a lot of those podcasts on functional nutrition and on integrative nutrition, I would find someone who's in that realm as well to help you sift through and understand if those if that information pertains to you. Because quite often they're dealing in what we call the weeds. And what we find really moves the needle on your health is to get, is to adjust your lifestyle and live the way the body is programmed to live before we layer on medications or supplements or routines that are out of the, out of your ability to do. You know, it's difficult to comply with. Right. You're not a 5 a.m. you know, early bird, that might not suit your body composition as well as it would someone else's who naturally wakes up at that hour. So just as an example, that's where I work is at Life Wellness Institute. And what we really work on is lifestyle medicine, which is really the foundation of functional medicine and integrative medicine, is really optimizing your body's health in natural ways before we look outward to other compounds and even foods that might enhance our health.
That's awesome. So I'm just going to jump. This might be all over the place, but I just want to throw things out I've been seeing on the internet and get your opinion on them. So do your nutritional needs change as you age?
They do to some degree. Absolutely. What we find is that we're after age 40, we start to lose lean muscle mass more so than laying it down as easily in the body. And so that can really impact our need for protein. And we're hearing an awful lot about that, which we could, that's a whole nother topic. I'm sure you'll probably get to that. But we do need to be sure that we're getting enough protein as we age. And some of the things that happen as we age is we become less efficient at absorbing some nutrients. Sometimes our dentition changes. So we might have tooth issues or have lost some teeth or have dental work that isn't, you know, as fitting as well or as well as it, you know, was when we had our natural teeth. And that can impact how well you're chewing, how the foods you choose. Maybe you stop choosing foods that are more fibrous, so you're not eating as many raw vegetables or nuts and seeds, and you're shifting into other foods. And then that can impact your ability to get enough minerals, enough fiber, things like that. So while the basic needs for nutrition don't change dramatically, there are definitely aspects as we age that we really need to pay attention to. And I would say the top three are probably getting enough protein and combining that with exercise, because you need them both. You can't just eat the protein and not exercise. You're not going to maintain your muscle, period. Getting enough fiber to keep your gut regular and your immune system up and running, and also regulate your metabolism, and staying well hydrated. I think those are the three top things that are I see as bigger struggles for people as we age.
Right. And you mentioned that at 40, we start to lose muscle mass. So just having extra protein in your diet doesn't solve that problem, right? Because you need to,
it doesn't.
You have to weight train to keep the muscle mass.
Absolutely. You're right. If you don't, you have to stress the muscle and create those micro tears so that you start the process of building muscle. It just won't build from just eating protein alone. You might get a little bit of gain from just adding protein if you're protein deficient. But if you're really trying to improve your lean body mass, so maybe mobilizing some fat mass and replacing it with muscle mass, which helps strengthen your bones. It makes us more steady on our feet because we're stronger, our balance is better, and our flexibility becomes better. So all of these things help with longevity in the long run. But if you don't get the protein in the diet plus the exercise, then you aren't getting the two components that work together to build the muscle.
So how much protein is needed per pound? Is there a set?
Yes. Well, it's not set in stone. And we've recently seen the dietary guidelines moved up a little bit. We used to deal in about 1 gram of protein, 0.8 to 1 gram of protein per kilo of body weight. And that's about half a gram of protein per pound, a little more than half a gram of protein per pound. And you'll see anywhere from a gram of protein per pound and up on the internet. And that does work well for some people. But in the long run, what it can do is having excess protein, depending on your body size too, and what your activity is and what your fitness goals might be. It can take away from getting enough other nutrients to fuel the body, for example. So if we're really focusing on protein, not getting enough carbohydrate, you might not actually be fueling the muscles well. So I like to take the shoot for around 1 to 1.2 grams of protein per kilo, maybe up to high as 1.4. So then we're really looking at about, what are we looking at about? I can't do the math. And
it's almost like maybe 0.75 per pound.
Yeah,
per pound.
Exactly. Yeah. About 0.75 per pound. Exactly. Yeah. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but if you've ever sat and tried to eat 150 grams of protein every day, which is kind of the magic number that's out on YouTube and out on the internet, the feedback I'm getting from a lot of my patients is that's a lot of protein to keep up with. And over time that they're struggling to do so. And what really creates health is what you can do on a daily basis rather than trying to strive for something that, you know, in excess really may not benefit you. We can only assimilate so many amino acids into the body in a given amount of time. So some of that excess protein will eventually be converted to fuel, but it can also be converted to fat storage if it's not fuel that's needed right away. So, you know, it's a little bit of a dance for each person figuring out what's exactly right for you.
That was like my next question, and you led right into it, is how many grams of protein at one sitting can a person have where their body can actually utilize it? Because, you know, there's a lot of the protein bars and stuff will have like 20 grams, some have 30 grams. And to me, that seems like a lot all at once, but.
It is quite a bit all at once. And we really want that balanced as well. And so the numbers that I have seen are anywhere from is anywhere from about 25 grams of protein in a sitting to about 40 grams of protein in a sitting. It could be higher than that, but that's the numbers that I'm familiar with. One of the things I think in the flaws of the protein bars are when they take out all of the carbohydrate and they're only giving you the protein. Mm-hmm. And especially if you're eating those post-workout, then you're not really you're not really refueling correctly. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a big flaw with all of the artificial sweeteners and the zero calorie sweeteners that are used in all the protein bars. I'd almost rather see a few grams of regular cane sugar in there if you're using it post-workout. You know, if you're only using it because you don't get enough protein otherwise, that's one thing. But these protein bars have been built on a platform for weight loss. And that platform for weight loss has long vilified carbohydrates as well as fats. And now we're hyper-focusing on protein. So I still don't think we're quite getting the messaging right for really how to use them appropriately.
Another question I had about muscle mass. Way back when I was in school, the first time I was in school, it seemed like they told us that at the age of 50, you can maintain your muscle mass, but you cannot gain muscle at that point in your life. Has that shifted? Do we now think that you can gain muscle as you get older?
Yes, you can, but it becomes more difficult because we're working against that whole aging scenario where the body is slowly losing some muscle mass, but you certainly can maintain it. But what you might find is if you didn't keep up with your fitness, it seems very daunting to begin with, but it definitely involves some resistance or strength training. You have to stay active and you need to be doing things that are more functional fitness per se. So also working on your flexibility and your balance and not just lifting weights. It all plays together. But yeah, you definitely can. You can definitely put on muscle and you can maintain it.
So going back to we were talking about those protein bars, that like there's so many of them have 0 grams of carbohydrate, 0 grams of sugar. So I think kind of what you're saying is that if you eat a protein bar that has no sugar post workout, then that the extra protein is going to be used for energy for your muscles, not to be laying down new muscle or used as energy in your body like a carbohydrate would be.
Right. So post-workout, your muscles, so what's happening in the workout is you're blowing through your carbohydrate stores, and then you start to break down, you go to your fat stores as you're working out, right, to fuel the body. And ideally, we're not breaking down muscle mass for fuel. We stress it out and create micro tears in the workout by asking it to do more work, right? But after the workout, those muscles still need carbohydrate and they want to store that carbohydrate mm-hmm. for you for the mm-hmm. next workout or the next mm-hmm. event or the rest of the day. But primarily mm-hmm. that comes out, that glycogen gets stored in the muscles and is used again at the next mm-hmm. workout.
Right.
So we want to have some carbohydrate in that mix post-workout because that's the fuel that those muscles still need. If not, mm-hmm. then they may use just that protein as fuel, and then you're not really getting the amino acids going to the muscles to build the muscle as efficiently. Right. And you might find that you get more gassed in your workouts. Simply mm-hmm. adding a little bit of carbohydrate post-workout can really help you perform better in the next workout.
Mm-hmm.
And it can also help you be leaner. So we've coached a lot of athletes who are trying to reduce their body fat composition, but they've cut their carbs so much, and we add some carbs back. And because they're so lean, they just burn that carb fuel so efficiently, and they've actually gotten leaner and met their goals. So you don't want to fear a little bit of carbohydrate.
So, but what does a little bit of carbohydrate mean?
Good question. So we're really looking at about, I would say, getting at least the same amount of carbs as grams of protein or twice as much post-workout.
Wow, okay.
Right. So what I like to tell people is ideally you have a meal after workout
mm-hmm.
or something that's like a larger snack. A protein bar that's 200 or 250 calories or lower just kind of isn't going to cut it. You're really mm-hmm. not going to get the nutrition you need. Because remember, you've also stressed the body, right? We want to stress mm-hmm. the body, want to make it work hard, put a demand on it, and then it needs fuel and nutrients to repair. So it doesn't just need carbohydrate, protein, and fat, but it could really use some antioxidants because you've just created a highly anti-inflammatory system in the mm-hmm. body, which is fine because it's from workout. From mm-hmm. exercise. That's good inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
But the body wants to respond with an anti-inflammatory action. And the way it best does that is if it has some antioxidants to do so. So if you follow with, say, a big salad with salmon or chicken, or you have lentil soup and a salad, or you're combining fruits and vegetables in that mix, because you just aren't going to get enough antioxidants or any antioxidants from, I would say, about 95% of the bars on the market.
Right.
Even if they throw a blueberry in there, it's not going to be enough, you know?
Right.
So,
That's now there's, and not all proteins equal or the same. Is that correct? So I know that, sometimes at the gym, there's these big bodybuilders around me and they're like, you know, you can't get, protein without animal sources. Cause that's what your body utilizes best. So plant protein isn't as readily available to you.
That is a little oversimplification.
Okay.
You absolutely can build muscle on plant-based proteins.
I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making a reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply.
Plant proteins are considered incomplete because one plant doesn't have all the amino acids, but another plant might have the amino acids that plant's missing. So the classic one that we talk about in vegetarian nutrition is combining rice and beans together because they have complementary amino acids, right? To make mm-hmm. a complete protein. So if your diet is well planned, you absolutely can get muscle gains with plant-based protein. The issue is you may not get as big as fast, but you can still build the muscle. So it is, it's not a lost cause, but it definitely, you can't be a carbohydrate vegetarian, reduced, just not really thinking about getting enough protein and really working on it because you do have to be more focused when you're on a vegetarian diet to get your protein. Unless you're using things like eggs as well. If you're incorporating dairy, then you're getting the leucine and things that are necessary for that muscle building. But it can be done. It's just perhaps not quite as efficient.
Right. So some of the plant-based protein powders that you can buy, like there's pea protein and a few other ones I can't think of right now, but are they complete proteins?
Pea protein, that's a good question, Barry.
I'm just curious because they're selling it as a protein powder. So I'm just wondering, do they add things so that it has all the amino acids or
usually not? In like some of the clean pea-based proteins that we're looking at, yellow pea might be the exception. So I'll have to look that one up though.
And like hemp also is a big thing.
Hemp would be, right. So hemp would not be a complete protein. That's often why I think we combine it with, like, you'll see rice protein with a hemp protein with, you know, sunflower protein. You'll see, like, all of these seeds and nuts put together to make something more complete. Yellow pea may be a standalone, and I have to check on that. So we might want to.
So if you do a plant-based protein, and let's say you're making it into a shake, and if I put it into a dairy product like skim milk, that would take care of that.
Make the complete.
Yeah.
And there's proteins they have tested, collagen protein versus pea protein and whey protein for muscle building. And what they found was that collagen did not meet this, did not support the muscle building as well as whey, but pea was a close second. So yellow pea protein is likely a complete protein.
Okay. Now in school, I'm going way back. So I studied nutrition in school. I had to take a class. And I remember at that time, the recommendation was that your protein was like 10 to 20%. Fat was like 20 to 30%. All the rest is carbohydrate. Does that still hold?
That still holds. Yeah. We still use that as a starting place for macros and then adjust from there, depending on what someone's needs are. So let's say 50% carbohydrate. If you're not eating the right type of carbohydrate, you might have high blood sugar. If you're eating low glycemic carbohydrates, you should be in good shape, but we might need to adjust that for your needs.
Okay. Now I'm going to get to some other things on the internet that I see. What is the deal with apple cider vinegar? Because I see that all over the place.
Yeah.
Should someone take that every day? How much should you take? And what is the benefit of that?
So apple cider vinegar, yeah, you're right. It's been around for a while and it kind of waxes and wanes in its popularity. You can take it as the apple cider vinegar itself. And if you do that, you want to be sure you're diluting it in water. Do not take it straight because it can burn your esophagus and damage the tissues. And the dose is about a tablespoon per 6 to 8 ounces of water, or you can take them as capsules. You can also buy them. So I think it's 2 or 3 capsules, probably depends on the capsule size. So just check the label. So apple cider vinegar can help with symptoms of reflux by slightly increasing the stomach acidity. And the way that works, you would think, why does higher stomach acidity help reflux, right? Because you already have too much acid. Well, if you don't have enough acid in your stomach, you have a little sphincter at the top of your stomach that will be more relaxed. And the more acid is in your stomach, the tighter it gets. So it can be helpful for some people with reflux. It can help improve digestion for some people. Apple cider vinegar is fermented, is a fermented food with some natural probiotics in it. So that can be very helpful for some people. But I think most people are probably taking it for weight loss or losing body fat. And the studies have been largely positive, with some exceptions where researchers did not find a benefit of losing fat or waist circumference with taking apple cider vinegar. The biggest study I saw found that if you did take apple cider vinegar, a tablespoon daily, at about the 16 to 18 week mark, their research subjects lost an inch off their waist.
Okay.
Another small study in 2024 found that their participants lost 18 pounds in about 3 months, on average, 18 pounds. Those researchers recently retracted that statement because they, and I'm not sure why, they found some confounding evidence in their study. Either there was something was poorly planned or their statistical analysis was incorrect. So what I usually tell people, you can try it and see if it works for you. But I think the biggest takeaway that from research as I found is if you stop taking it, then you might gain that weight back. So experts have suggested just incorporating more vinegar in general into your diet. So having it on, like, vinegar and oil on salads and things like that. And, you know, coleslaws or things, anything else that you use vinegar in, that can be very helpful.
I have read that your, like, disease doesn't work as well in your body if you are more pH or more alkaline in your
body. More alkaline.
Right? So does that, like, is it, so does it, would it make sense if I took a tablespoon of baking soda in hot water every day?
Good question. So baking soda every day is not a great idea. Baking soda can reduce the pH. In fact, it's used in a prescription form for people who have chronic kidney disease, who are in metabolic acidosis, which means their acid levels are so high that they take sodium bicarbonate to reduce it. So that's given as a prescription. It is not recommended that healthy people take a teaspoon of sodium bicarbonate or baking soda daily. And the reason being is it has a boatload of sodium in it. It is literally sodium with a bicarbonate molecule added, and there's about 1,200 milligrams per teaspoon of sodium bicarbonate. So that makes it, can have a big impact on your blood pressure. Over time, it can have a big impact on your kidneys in an unhealthy way, kind of stress them out. So I really don't recommend using sodium bicarbonate on a regular basis. It's okay once in a while for, say, indigestion, but I wouldn't make it a daily practice.
I'm Renee Sandell from Bethesda, Maryland. I'm an artist, educator, and author. And the ranch is my divine place, almost like the Garden of Eden. Always beautiful, always creative, always transforming every time I come. And I love working with the guests because I engage them in something I've developed in part from the ranch and inspired by Deborah, called Visual Fitness for All. And that means I help people see more in life through art. I help them decode meaning, looking at Mexican art, and especially the art of Frida Kahlo. And I also engage them in creativity exercises. And what I find is that folks really love, they're very open when they're here because of all the beauty, all the nurturing, and so forth. And they surprise themselves. They didn't know that they could create different ways of visual meaning. And so that has been a joy for me. So I come here to find myself amidst creativity, vision, virtues, and a joyful staff and other presenters. It is just, there's no place like it.
I hope you are finding today's podcast informative and enjoyable. If you wish to learn more about our exciting presenters and programs, visit our events calendar on the Rancho La Pura website and see what's coming up in the future. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation. Now back to today's interview. So that brings me to the other thing that's one thing I see on the internet all the time is pink salt. Everyone should be doing Himalayan pink salt, you know?
Yes.
And I always watched this one older lady. She was like 90, and she her success in life, she said, and her health is based on a glass of water when she first wakes up with pink salt in it.
So what she's doing is making like an electrolyte beverage, is putting some sodium chloride and some minerals that are in the pink salt, which is what gives it the pink color, into some water and drinking those down. And it might make her feel much better because it actually does improve hydration. Having those, you know, sodium or a little bit of glucose molecules in there helps pull the fluid into the bloodstream. But I think what a lot of people are misled about the pink salt, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad practice if it's a pinch of salt, like what we would find in electrolytes, a very small amount. But a lot of these natural salts are, they do contain minerals, but they contain them in very small amounts. So they're not a good physiological source of minerals for you. It's not harmful, but it's a bit of a misnomer for them to say, oh, and they're packed with magnesium and, you know, all these other minerals you need and the selenium you need and yada, yada, yada. When actually we don't want you to have that much salt to get that much mineral to make it, you know, a benefit for your health. So you really need to get your minerals elsewhere.
Well, there's a all over the internet too. There's some pink salt diet thing that everyone's doing now too, but I haven't ever watched it long enough to see what it is.
So. I've missed that one.
So let's talk about another superfood is cinnamon, right?
Yeah.
So what are the benefits of cinnamon and how much of that can you have a day?
So cinnamon is interesting. It does have some blood sugar lowering properties. The issue is you have to have quite a bit of it each day. It's upwards of a teaspoon or more of cinnamon. So often we'll take it in capsules. The issue with cinnamon is it has a compound that is carcinogenic, and that is not what we want to be ingesting on a regular basis. What I have found in my clinical practice is when my patients are taking cinnamon and they still don't have good dietary practices, or they aren't moving their bodies enough, they're still struggling with blood sugar. So cinnamon alone isn't going to cut it. You really do need to cut your sugars, watch your refined flour, eating plenty of fiber, and getting your protein each day and moving your body to use the fuel that you're consuming. If you use the fuel you're consuming, then it won't remain in your blood sugar or remain in your bloodstream and create high blood sugar. But so cinnamon on its own, it's really not It's not a supplement that I go to if I'm trying to help somebody lower their blood sugar. What I'll usually do is have them use a continuous glucose monitor to see what foods are actually causing the problem, and then we work from there. Because sometimes it's just some things we don't know, or it's stress-related, purely stress-related, and we need to do something else to help deal with stress, and it's not the food at all.
Well, it's, yeah, so I didn't know that the cinnamon had a carcinogen.
You can get too much of it. Now, I use it every day on top of my latte, but I'm probably getting about an eighth to a quarter of a teaspoon tops, maybe, a day. Yeah. And if people want to know what the limit is, I can look up what that limit is again.
I mean, because I do research for the ranch on that. I probably do almost a tablespoon a day on top of my oatmeal. So maybe it's
yummy.
It's a bit much, maybe. How about turmeric for anti-inflammation?
Yeah, turmeric has a very good track record, very safe track record for use for inflammation in the body. The American Arthritis Foundation recommends 500 milligrams of turmeric a day or twice a day to help with arthritis pain. So it can be very helpful. I have a lot of patients taking turmeric, and I would keep the dose under 2,000 milligrams a day, and I would start with the lowest dose that works for you. So I would start around that 500 milligram mark and see if you're getting good coverage there, and then maybe adding another 500 and see if that's enough. The reason being is turmeric can cause stomach upset. Mm-hmm. It's used in, I believe, in Chinese medicine to help flush the gallbladder, and in some people it can cause a gallbladder spasm, which is no big deal if you don't have small stones in the gallbladder, which many people do, and those little tiny stones can stay in there and not cause a problem until they get flushed up into the little bile duct and cause pain. Mm. So if you get upper right quadrant pain, like under your rib cage, that might, when you take turmeric, that might be one of the reasons. It can also cause nausea and diarrhea in high doses. So just start slow and take the minimum you need for to reduce inflammation.
No, that's interesting because I've often heard that you have to have a lot of turmeric to have the anti-inflammatory benefit. So that's not necessarily true then.
Not necessarily true. But some of it could be placebo, because a lot of times that is a very real effect of some of the supplements and even medications we take. Mm-hmm. We've seen it well studied in cancer patients. When cancer patients believe that their medication, their treatments are going to work, they tend to have better outcomes. So, you know, the body is a very powerful healer. So I think that's why I just say start slow and work up to about 2,000 milligrams. You have to remember in food, if you eat it in food, what we're trying to get is the curcumin. So turmeric contains curcumin, which is the active compound. And so we're looking at from supplements are 95% curcumin, where food is 2 to 9%. So if you're getting it just from, say, the turmeric plant itself, it's in much lower doses. So when you take it from a supplement, just be, you know, just go slow, just make sure. And not everybody is sensitive to every herb also. Right. We see this with like cholesterol lowering herbs like citrus bergamot and berberine. Mm-hmm. Not everyone's sensitive to those. So they don't work for everyone.
Right.
So same thing with turmeric. Sometimes some people just aren't getting the relief because that might not be, the turmeric may not be working on the pain pathway that they're experiencing, the source that they're dealing with.
Yeah. Sounds like we have to listen to our bodies. Damn it. Yeah.
I know. They have opinions for sure.
Right. What about NAD?
Yeah.
That is all over the place. What is that, and why is it so popular right now?
NAD is all over the place because of the anti-aging effects that it is believed to be involved in. And it's been very, very well studied. It has a high safety profile. There's been some small studies perhaps linking it to cancers, but nothing causal. So really, overall, it's overwhelmingly looked at as safe. NAD helps these compounds called sirtuins, which regulate cell metabolism, DNA repair, and inflammation. And they also help your body be more resistant to stress. But that NAD isn't made in the body without the molecule niacin. So niacin is different than NAD. Niacin is the precursor for NAD. So you need a little bit of niacin to make the NAD. You can also take the NAD itself. And then that's where we're seeing that in the longevity medicine and trying to protect our DNA, protect the cells, and extend their, you know, the life of the mitochondria, which are the little energy power plants, and ultimately just reduce inflammation.
So niacin alone doesn't do the same effects?
Well, it can. If you get enough niacin, it can. Mm-hmm. It is the precursor for NAD. So theoretically, it's going to drive that NAD level up. However, that is a metabolic reaction that needs to happen. And if you need to have certain cofactors to make that happen as well. The flaw with taking more niacin is that niacin can cause a really uncomfortable flush for people. So NAD, taking the NAD might be more comfortable for most people than just simply adding a high dose of niacin.
Well, what if you buy the non-flush niacin supplements? Are they absorbed the same?
They are. They are absorbed the same, but they're still just the precursor for NAD. So okay. You may or may not get the same benefit as if you just took straight NAD.
And isn't niacin also touted to kind of help with cholesterol?
Yes, it is. We used to add it to a statin to get better cholesterol controls. We've had some studies say that really isn't helping to combine the two. Mm-hmm. But niacin really helps lower triglycerides, helps push up HDL, and makes the HDL more functional because the HDLs are the scavengers that go collect cholesterol that isn't put into use by the body and bringing it back to liver safely. So niacin is very useful. But again, a lot of people can't take it due to the flush.
But I think, does your body get used to it? Because I've been taking it now. I take 1,000 every night.
Yeah, so it definitely can get used to it. And that's why we usually start people slow, just like 500 milligrams and work up. And probably I wouldn't exceed 1,200 to 1,500 milligrams. But again, take the least amount you need to get the health benefit your desire.
So I have a few friends in Hollywood that are talking all about creatine. Creatine is the new thing that everyone needs to be doing for your brain.
Yes.
Is that true?
So creatine is all over the place. And creatine is something else that also has a pretty high safety profile. The recommended range is anywhere from, say, 4 to 10 grams a day. Most people do well with that 4 to 5 gram range. It can cause gas and bloating. So if you started taking it and you magically got gassy and weren't quite sure what that was all about, it could be your creatine. You could stop your creatine for a couple of days and then start it up and see if that changes any of that experience. Mm-hmm. Creatine can be great for brain health. The study subjects really have only been older adults, not so much younger adults. So we don't really know if we don't really have the evidence to say in younger adults is as effective, but it can help executive function in older individuals. So we're probably looking at 65 and up. Mm-hmm. In younger people, it's definitely been found to help with muscle recovery and help muscle gains, strength, particularly in athletes, which is what a lot of the research has been done in.
So, but if it would do that for younger people, it would do that for older people too? Help with muscle recovery as well as brain health?
It can. It can definitely help with strength in older people. Mm-hmm. There just hasn't been as many studies on older people, to my knowledge, as there have been in, say, athletes.
Got it.
But it's very clear that there's some definite definite benefits. I wrote an article on it a few months ago on our website, and I can forward that to you if you want. Some great detail about which groups of people benefit most. Interestingly, vegetarians might benefit the most because creatine is typically found in animal proteins and animal products. Okay. So that might be something that if vegetarians are trying to make some muscle gains, adding creatine could be very helpful.
Okay.
There is one piece of new research on creatine that I do want people to know, and just so you have the knowledge you need, is that some cancer researchers have found that creatine can act as an energy shuttle for cancer cells. And so in highly metastatic cancers, things like pancreatic, and I think they even named some prostate cancers, that they really don't advise it for people who have had cancer or who have cancer. So that would be probably advised to stay away from until we know more about what this actually means.
How about melatonin?
Melatonin can work great. It's believed to be safe. Most people take too much of it. The recommended dose is 0.3 to 3 milligrams. And sometimes taking more isn't more effective. So I usually recommend people start with a 1 milligram tablet and see if that works, and then add an additional tablet till you get to about the 3 and see where that, if you can find a sweet spot there.
And so I forgot to mention that it's for sleep, right? For helping people sleep, right?
Yeah. Yes, for sleep.
Right. I read somewhere that melatonin is also good for your brain.
I have heard a lot of claims made about melatonin that I'm not well versed on.
Right.
Yeah. I think I've heard some concerns about it as well. Like, don't be giving it to your kids, that it's not great for their developing brains, for their sleep. But I'm not so sure.
But melatonin is naturally produced in your brain, correct?
Yes, it is.
So if you take melatonin artificially, does it make your brain's production go down?
I think it can. I think it's a little bit beyond my knowledge base here, but from what I have read is that molecules in the body act in this feedback loop, that once we get to a certain amount, then it's kind of more kind of shuts it off. And it's the body's way of regulating that pathway so that it can become less effective over time. And I believe melatonin can have that same effect. So sometimes cycling on and off of it is what I've told my patients to do. Only using it when you need it, maybe not as a daily or nightly practice.
Is it also good to get one that's released throughout the night? Like a slow release?
It can be.
Yeah.
It can be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, now here comes this is a selfish question for me and all the men listeners about prostate health. Prostate health, I'm curious about, because I've been studying a lot about that at my age. And so here are some of the things that I've found on the internet that are supposed to be great for your prostate health. Saw palmetto, mm-hmm. Pumpkin seed oil, grape seed extract, and iodine. Have you heard of any of that?
I have heard of the first three, and they do have good evidence behind them. The iodine I'm less familiar with.
Okay.
Iodine is a molecule that I do treat with great respect, the same way I treat selenium with great respect. And I would just do a little more research on the iodine before just taking it, because iodine can also affect your thyroid. And depending on if you have an overactive or underactive thyroid or something that hasn't been diagnosed yet, that might affect it.
Right.
It goes down other multiple pathways in the body, just not to the prostate. But yes, I've heard that pumpkin seed oil for years, pumpkin seeds are great for men to add to their diet. Saw palmetto can be highly anti-inflammatory, and all good choices.
So is there anything else for the prostate that I forgot to mention that you have heard?
Yeah, I have a couple years ago, they came out. Well, for years, we've talked about the effects of dairy proteins on the prostate and what they have found in these observational studies. So we haven't proved, causation, but in observational studies, men that consumed more dairy tended to have more prostate issues, not necessarily cancer. But a couple years ago, a study came out and said that what they found was that dairy proteins in particular did cause more aggressive prostate cancers. Not cause them, I'm sorry, had an effect of driving more aggressive prostate cancer growth than those who had less dairy proteins. And when they gave us the amount, it was less than if men consumed about a quarter cup of milk, they were getting too much dairy protein. So what I've told men, when I see PSAs, the prostate-specific antigen lab tests, if their PSAs are starting to rise and they're high dairy consumers, I usually advise them maybe start using some plant-based milks, pare it down a little bit if they're getting a lot of dairy. So, I've had some patients that, drink 2, 3, 4 cups of milk a day in their 60s and 70s. And I would say younger men are probably more on the yogurt train than the fluid milk train as much. We see these kind of generational shifts.
Mm-hmm.
Cheeses, things like that. What they found was that fluid milk, so anything that has fluid milk in it, so that would be, milk, ice cream, any kind of dairy product like a pudding or something like that, had the effect. But that yogurt and cheese, they did not see the same effect. So that's why we usually just have that discussion about watch how much of the fluid dairy, and maybe don't overeat dairy, period. One, there's other reasons.
Would cottage cheese go under the same category as yogurt?
Yeah.
So healthier for you, right?
Yes, cottage cheese would go in the same category.
And higher protein, lower fat.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, now, I literally could talk to you for 4 hours, but now I'm going to make myself really sad and ask you one last question. Mm-hmm. What about alcohol?
Oh, alcohol. Okay, I'm just the messenger, okay?
Don't I know you're just, because lately the things I've been reading, Jude, there was this wow, you know, with the Blue Zones came out and everyone was like, everyone should have a glass of wine a day. It's great for you.
Yeah.
Now it's kind of shifted to like no alcohol is the best thing.
Yeah. And that shift came from more research on cancers. So one of the beneficial things about alcohol that the Mediterranean diet addresses is that in small quantity, it can create a sense of conviviality and camaraderie at mealtimes, which is also really good for humans to have that community, that sense of community. However, you look at the Mediterranean diet and you look at the centenarians that they're studying, they're having very small amounts of alcohol a day. It's like, looks like a thimbleful compared to, you know, a wine glass we would typically see in a wine bar. So, but again, the recent research, we've had so much more research on cancer and the effects of alcohol. So at its core, the alcohol is the carcinogen. So, and then it's cloaked in this delicious sauce, if you will, that, you know, has all the good red wine resveratrol in it or the other tasty components. But It is a carcinogen at the end of the day. So it is dose and frequency dependent about its effect in the body. So the advice is coming through that it just less really is more. And so we really do need to be thinking about reducing our intake. And I think some of the original guidance comes from food lobbies. You know, the beverage industry is fierce as far as its lobbying, as far as how long we've seen Coca-Cola and these large companies hang on to how much sugar is going into these products and where they get advertised and who they get advertised to, including children. You know, alcohol is part of that, you know, beverage association. So it's a tough, you know, I agree. It's sad for some. But so many people have, you know, do dry January and say they feel so much more amazing. Their sleep quality's improved, their energy, they've lost those couple pounds they wanted to take off.
I agree. We talked a lot about a lot of different kinds of supplements. A lot of people will just go on Amazon to buy supplements, but I imagine you don't know what you're getting. So what advice would you give people to buy high quality supplements?
I definitely would buy high quality supplements. I wouldn't just buy any random smaller label brand. You're best off to stick with the big brands. And just because they're more expensive doesn't always mean that they're better. So, you know, I have some kind of, I've done private label supplements for a couple of different spas and I'm pretty well versed in supplements. There are definitely some brands that are better. Typical practitioner brands often have higher, I don't know if they're necessarily higher standards, but my trust level in them is a little bit higher because they're small batch. And if there is something wrong with a batch, we're going to hopefully catch it sooner and it's going to be off the market sooner and affect fewer people. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that does make sense.
Yeah. And also in these quote unquote practitioner brands, as we like to call them, they typically don't have a lot of additives. They don't have colorants. They don't have things that make them stick together. And they're mostly capsules or they could be liquids. And that helps minimize additional things that you just don't need in your body. Chemicals and compounds that, you know, they use like glues and things that hold things together, excipients that make things flow smoothly or don't stick inside the capsules or the tablets dissolve so that you don't need all that extra stuff. You just need the nutrients and the capsule.
How much of a supplement is actually absorbed by your body? Because I have my pills I take in the morning, my supplements, and the ones I take at night. And I know that after I take mine in the morning and then I urinate, I'm just like, ooh, there they all go.
Yeah, it's super common for any supplements that contain B vitamins to tinge your urine temporarily.
Yeah. Okay.
And they're probably not all going down the toilet, but you definitely, let's put it this way too. If they're in your urine, you absorbed them.
Oh, okay.
If they're in your poop, you didn't absorb them. They went straight through. So once to be able to get into the urine, they have to get into the bloodstream, go through the kidney, and then the kidney filters it out and puts it into the urine. So you do absorb them. I prefer capsules or liquids because of that absorption issue. Right. Tablets are more difficult to dissolve in the GI tract. And especially as we age, you know, I think that getting those tablets, especially some of the big horse pill vitamins, you know, if it's a multi, sometimes they're huge and those can be difficult to swallow and may not dissolve as readily. Yeah. So I always look for a capsule. The other little tip I tell people is on a multivitamin. If you have a really healthy diet, you may not need to take a multivitamin every single day. So one of the ways of actually even controlling the cost also of the multivitamin is to buy those in capsule form. When they're in capsules, it's a powder. It's not compacted tight. So there's not as much in each capsule. So you'll typically see on a multivitamin label from a capsule, anywhere from 2 to 4 capsules a day. Mm-hmm. Take one a day. And then that way it's more economical, but then you're just supplementing the body instead of giving the body everything it needs in a pill. You really should be getting most of everything the body needs from your food, because it's bound together with other nutrients that it needs. It's there with the fiber that helps it get utilized. It's there with the antioxidants that help get it mm-hmm. utilized. And when we take those nutrients out and just put them in a pill, they do react a little bit differently. Right. So use your multivitamin as a supplement to your diet is the best advice I can give.
That's awesome. So, well, gosh, thanks for spending this time with me today. And I know you're going to be, you'll be down doing a lecture for our guests a couple times this year, and I'm looking forward to seeing you then. So
yeah, I'm looking forward to getting down there. I can't wait.
Yeah. I appreciate you spending this time. I could keep going, but I think I should probably
thanks,
stop.
Barry. I could go all day. We could keep going.
We could. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
I love today's podcast. I certainly learned a lot. I hope you found it informative as well. When it comes to nutrition, actually when it comes really to anything, you can't trust everything you read. The things that are on the internet, just because they're on the internet doesn't necessarily mean they are true. For example, a supplement, I learned this today, a supplement that might be good for most people might not be good for someone who has a certain medical condition or some kind of a genetic makeup that supplement doesn't work for them. Linda's advice today, which is great, is you need to make sure you have science backing the decisions that you make. Find a good nutritionist or someone who has a background, who does the science and does the research for you. Don't just blindly do everything that you see online. And hey, listen to your body, because one size doesn't fit all. Until next time, wishing you health and daily joy.